Good afternoon. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 1:30 on the dot.
Yes, indeed.
February 16, 2010. With me for this afternoon session is my, well, my Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, and Senator Thomas will be joined by the other members here shortly. I'm sure they're all in the building. This afternoon, we'll continue our technical review of the Alaska Oil and Gas Tax Structure. Our first presentation is on the oil industry's employment and resident hiring practices from the Department of Labor, and then we'll finish this afternoon on transportation costs dealing with that issue and the impacts it has on our netback. We'll go ahead and begin with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development on the oil industry employment and resident hire, and with us today from the Department of Labor is Mr. Jeff Hardlin. He's the Economist Research Program Supervisor. And if he can come forward, identify himself for the record, go ahead and walk through this presentation, and again, we're going to try to keep this focused on the Arctic oil and gas. But there's a lot of information in your packet, and we'll work through it as we go through. Go ahead, Mr. Hardlin.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jeff Hadlin. I'm an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Today, I'm going to give you a brief presentation on the oil industry employment, unemployment, and resident hire. First, I'd like to go over some of the data series that we use to develop these numbers. The primary source of information related to employment in Alaska is derived from quarterly unemployment insurance contribution reports. For each employer, each quarter, we obtain the Social Security number, the occupation, the place of work, and the wages for each worker for each employer. So we know the industry, we know the employment for each of those employers. In addition, we have unemployment insurance unemployment insurance records. Each claimant files each week, and so we have that data as well. We know the occupation in which that unemployed worker was employed. We also match all of this data with administrative data files, including the permanent fund dividend file, and that's our primary source of information for residency. In addition to these, in addition to this data reported by employers, we also conduct surveys on a regular basis, and that's based upon a monthly survey of employers, and so we get employment data from them as well. Just in terms of an overview, the oil industry in Alaska had an average annual employment for 2009, which will be slightly higher than 2008. But the last half of the year did show a decline in employment. So although the average is higher, at the end of the year, we're looking at a decline, and the trend is continuing down slightly. Major oil company employment was stable over the year, but oil field services employment is dragging down the numbers.
If we could stop there, what slide are you on? Are you on number two still? 1980 to 2010, or?
Yes, that's our. Yes. Okay. So if you look at 2009, we're down slightly. I'll have a monthly slide which will give you a little more detail, but the 2009 numbers are showing a slight decline. And then on this slide as well, we have a projection which shows continuing decline year over year into 2010, slight decline. So in terms of our forecast, we're looking at, from 2009 to 2010, a 0.4% decline in jobs. overall in for statewide employment, and a 3% decline in oil industry employment from 2009 to 2010.
Just a second. Before, we need to try to attempt to parse out Point Thompson, parse out general maintenance, and try to zero in on I guess everybody else. So any help you can offer the committee and head in that direction would be appreciated. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was kind of the same area I was getting at. Is there what the explanation was of the somewhat dramatic rise from 2005 to 2009 in that four-year period of time? That was a pretty dramatic increase. And if there were some particularly significant projects or occurrences that took place that caused that kind of dramatic rise, or if you know, or if it's going to be later in the presentation.
Senator, through the chair, basically we aren't able to break out individual projects. We can identify employment changes by employer. We can identify employment changes by borough or census area, broad places of work. We can break out changes of employment by occupation, but we can't break them out by particular projects. Unless we knew the exact, I'll say the Social Security numbers of the individual workers that were working on those projects, in that case we could track those numbers. But in general, we don't and aren't able at this point to track by individual oil development projects.
Just one thing. Then I guess as I look at you looking forward into the future for a forecast, you must certainly be looking at some particular areas that are going to increase workers. So I would have thought if we backed up and with the statistics that you create, what you were creating at that time back in 2003, 4, and 5, your projections for the next few years, however long or however far out they are, we wouldn't even then be able to find that there was a particular field that you had anticipated coming on, and that's why the projections at that time would have increased, maybe not kept pace with what the reality was, but at least showed some projection like you're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, we look at a number of factors in terms of our employment projections. Among them are revenues estimates and projections in terms of development in terms of oil revenues, and then we rely upon industry sources and news sources in terms of identification of anticipated growth. But other than that, we can only look at the history of employment in a particular industry sector in order to project the future.
That's good. Thank you.
To continue, we've been joined by Senator Egan, Senator Huggins, and my co-chair, Senator Hoffman. Go ahead and continue.
looking at the next slide, percent resident workers in the oil and gas industry. If you note, over the last, since 2002, there has been an overall increase in the percent non-resident workers, and a lot of that is in conjunction with the increased reliance on oil field service companies to do a lot of the work. The major oil company resident hire statistics have been fairly stable, but the oil field service sector tends to be a little bit higher, something more comparable to the construction industry in terms of a resident hire performance. So as the number of workers in that portion of the industry has increased, the resident hire non-resident hire percentage has increased as well.
If we can just go back to your slide number two. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of awkward with not having an overhead, but on slide number two, showing oil and gas employment, 2004 there was slightly over 8,000, and 2010 maybe 12,500 for 2,500 people. But if you go to the next slide and you look at the residents from 04 to 08, looks to me like it dropped in percentages. So can you give us numbers on that in state so we can compare, instead of percentage, we can actually look at headcount?
We produce an annual resident hire report, and we do have those numbers available, and I can provide those to you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Now, again, on the our fourth slide with total workers, SSNs working by quarter in the Alaska oil industry. Again, I'm showing the number of unique individuals that were employed in the oil support sector versus the oil extraction sector. And again, over the last 2 years, you can see the blue line of oil extraction has been a fairly stable at about around 4,000 workers over these last 8 quarters. And there was certainly an increase in the oil support sector during that period. But in third quarter 2009, we did see that drop off, and that's when the decline was first starting to appear in terms of total worker accounts.
Could you bring us back some additional quarters so we can back up and pick up the entire length of the PPT, go back to 90? Go back to 05, not in the 90s, but.
Yes, quarterly data is available for the last 20 years or so. So we can certainly go back, Mr. Chair, and provide that to you.
Because we're trying to get a feel for how much is in employment and effort and credits, time and dollars is going into oil extraction versus oil support.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now the next slide with monthly oil industry employment for Alaska from 2005 to 2009. Again, you can put the oil industry in a little longer perspective and get a sense of the employment pattern that we've been seeing. In January 05, which is the starting point of this particular chart, you see average monthly employment in the oil industry was something over 8,000 workers. And more recently, we've been looking at around 13,000 workers on a monthly basis. So certainly more than 50% increase in employment during that time period. But in the most recent several months, we certainly have seen a drop off as well. Now the next slide, I alluded to it earlier, but you can see the percentage non-resident workers in the oilfield services in total for the oil industry and the oil and gas extraction or oil extraction industry sectors. And so the dark blue line is oil and gas extraction, the gray line is the total, and the lighter blue line is the oil field services. And so over time you can see the how those rates have diverged and changed. The next chart is unemployment insurance claimants for the oil industry and all industry sectors in Alaska from calendar year 2003 to 2009. We've had a lot of questions about the number of UI claimants in general and the oil industry in particular. And you will see in 2009 there certainly was a significant increase in over 2008 in the oil industry, more than doubling claims in that particular industry sector. Overall, for all industries, claims went up about 50%. So certainly a significant difference there.
Senator Hoffman.
looking at that and comparing that to the previous chart, is that a rise because they are hiring more out-of-state workers, non-resident workers?
The increase in unemployment is related to, unemployment insurance claimants can be caused by many different factors.
But they're not employed, and the ones that are being employed to fill those jobs, it looks as though are non-resident workers from the previous page here.
Through the chair.
When you look at total oil, it went up from 29.3 to 29.8 from 07 to 08. We don't have 09 numbers, but the trend looks as though it's since 2002, the trend for the oil industry has been a market increase of non-resident workers in the oil industry.
Through the chair. In terms of an increase in unemployment insurance claimants, it's not residents, it's not non-residents, it's all workers that have been affected by the downturn. It's not a disproportionate share of non-resident workers that were that have been receiving unemployment insurance benefits.
But on that same page, Mr. Chairman, you're looking at the oil industry in-state claimants from 2008 was 1,208. It just about doubled to 2,331. And you go all the way back to 2006, it was way down to 795. So clearly the claims are increasing for in-state claimants.
Through the chair, the interstate claimants are claims that were filed out of state, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they were non-residents. It means that some of them are residents that left the state to look for work, and perhaps given the national economy, they may have been unsuccessful. So it's not necessarily just non-residents that are interstate claimants.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to the previous chart, the percent of non-resident workers. So in extraction, the companies have about a 25% out-of-state workforce, but when they contract out for oil field services, the numbers spike up. I've had several constituents. When I appear on radio shows, I always get a call or two from folks I read about non-Alaskans working on the slopes and jobs that Alaskans previously held. Maybe that's when it was an oil company function, and then when it's contracted out to an oil field services company, they bring in more out-of-state workers. Here the average is 31% here, or spiked up to 32.4%. Are there companies then that might have, this is an average, so there may be companies that have a much higher non-resident workforce, and this is just the percentage among all oil field service companies?
Through the chair. Certainly there are differences between employer, and we publish annually a list of the resident hire rates for each employer in Alaska, so that information is available. Some employers tend to have a higher resident workforce, some don't, and sometimes it can be related to the particular skill set that's required for the workers and any number of reasons, but certainly it's the case that the rate varies between employers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the last fellow that was giving me a hard time on the radio interview or radio program was claiming between 50% and 60% of the oilfield service company that he was dealing with or knew of on the slope. He claimed to have personal firsthand information. He said it was anywhere between 50% and 55% non-resident workforce, and that when it was the oil company doing the job, it was about 75% Alaskans, about 25% non-residents, for whatever reason. But that when they contract out the work, it goes the wrong way in terms of Alaskan employment. So I think there are a number of outfits that have significantly higher than 32% non-resident workforce. but this is where it averages out.
Did you help the committee with any additional information on that question as far as individual companies, or is everything aggregated?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly provide the resident hire rates for each employer in Alaska and all of the all of the oil companies and oil field service companies with greater than 20 workers in the year. That information is public. So.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate that, to know who are the good guys and who are the bad actors in terms of Alaska hire. Maybe it would create some pressure for people to hire in-state.
Okay. Well, certainly more information is better than less information on a lot of areas. So if you can bring that back to the committee, that'd be appreciated.
We've talked about the unemployment insurance claimants in general. Again, I provided the next slide as a Alaska Unemployment Insurance weeks paid by month. This just provides a little more detailed information on a monthly basis on the number of weeks that that were paid in the oil extraction and oil field services sectors. As you can see again, in the last several months, there's been a significant increase in the number of weeks paid in the oil industry. I provided a copy of our most recent press release just to give you an overview of the unemployment rate in Alaska and where we stand in terms of employment. I won't go into any detail on this, but that's available on our website as well and gives you a good overview of the on a monthly basis. What's happening in Alaska in terms of the unemployment rate and the in total employment in the state. And the very final slide that I have is a monthly oil industry employment in the U.S. as a total from 2005 to 2009. In this case, we're looking at oil extraction and the oil support sector in NAICS code, for those who like NAICS codes and understand them and use them, 213112, and that's the oil field services sector in particular. We don't have the exact same numbers at a national level that we use for the oil, the combined oil industry that we used in our other tables, but again, you can see on a national basis there's been a spike in the oil industry employment in 2008, and then a drop off into 2009.
So you have this information I see here for the U.S. from 05 to 09, and that's monthly. You also have that same information for Alaska, correct?
It's a similar table, a chart to the monthly chart.
Page four.
Yeah, fourth chart. There's a slight definitional difference, which is the point I was making, because the our chart includes 213112 and 213111 in terms of NAICS codes. So there's a slight difference just because of availability of information. Yet it's not, the national data is not available at that level, but it's very close, and it gives you an idea on the trend in terms of the overall oil industry in the nation.
Well, what would be helpful for the committee if we matched up the charts, the x-axis, because we've got. And then, or even better yet, you can take the data from the national on monthly or quarterly, in the state on monthly, quarterly, so and run a regression on it and come back and let us know how they're correlated.
Mr. Chair,
clearly there's some relative information here that could be pertinent to what we're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, we'll do that.
We have any other? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make sure I understand this, and some of the response confused me a little bit. In the slide 1980 to 2010, 2003 to 2009, employment is up in the industry and then flattens out the last couple of years.
Senator Thomas, what tape, chart, or page are you on?
Well, they don't have page numbers, so I wasn't sure. That's why I was writing separately. I'm looking at the first one is the Alaska Oil and Gas Employment, 1980 to 2010. Shows trending up. employment trending up. Just trying to make this connection between employment and unemployment, I guess. So we have the trend up generally and then flattening out in the last couple of years. And then the next slide shows percent of resident workers down, trending down, and then flattening out a little at the end, but still trending down a fair percentage. And then I skip over a couple and get to the all the way up to the one that shows the UI claimants, in-state claimants, up over the last couple of years. And it just seems to make sense to me that if the employment is up, but the unemployment claims, particularly for in-state, are also up, then obviously the people that are being employed are not Alaskan residents, or else it wouldn't, or else it would not be that same trend, both of them going up. If it was Alaskans being put back to work, then the trend would be down for unemployment, if the trend for employment is up, which is what it's been. Am I missing something there? Employment's going up, unemployment claims are also going up. So there's more people unemployed, but if there's more people employed.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, the employment decline occurred in the last half of 2009, and that's when we're seeing the spike in unemployment insurance claimants as well. So although the average for the year is trending up, if we look at it on a monthly basis, we can see that the employment is going down. And so that's driving some of that. Now, even in an increasing employment environment, you can have an increase in claims when you have turnover, or perhaps a particular project ends and another project begins, and it requires a different type of crew. For instance, the largest number of unemployment insurance claimants that we have now are electricians, plumbers and pipe fitters, roustabouts. Those are the occupations that are rising in terms of the oil industry unemployment insurance claims. So, for instance, if there were layoffs in the headquarters offices of the oil companies, you'd have a different mix, and if there was turnover and that sort of thing. So that they aren't necessarily in conflict, but in this case, there is an actual decline in employment, and that has resulted in an increase in unemployment insurance claims.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have any other questions for Mr. Hadlin? I think I got your name correct this time. I'm getting better
yes.
At practice. Any final questions for him? Okay, if you could then come back to the committee with some of that, and maybe you can razzle us and dazzle us with your statistical mind and help us with the regression similarities between what's going on nationally in the oil industry and what's going on North Slope. Well, with employment in the oil extraction and oil support would help. Okay. And then increase the x-axis field on chart on page 4. So it goes back previous to 2008, back before PPT, which is 06.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll take it. Okay. We'll do that.
Yeah, and thank you for coming over. Next up, our second final presentation for the day is the topic's going to be oil transportation costs. And these costs include the tariff associated with using the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to ship our oil from the North Slope to Washington and California for processing. And here to present from the Department of Revenue is Joyce Lofgren.
Joyce Lofgren.
And Donna Keepers. Petroleum economist and audit master.
That's us.
Pardon me?
That's us.
Okay. If you can introduce yourself for the record and take us through your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Donna Keppers, audit master for the Department of Revenue Tax Division. And I've been with the division for a year and a half. And prior to that, I spent 9 years working for Alyeska Pipeline and the prior 9 working for Mabico Alaska Petroleum, the North Pole Refinery. And then prior to that, I was in Texas working on shallow wells. Presenting with me today is Joyce Lofgren. She is one of our petroleum economists and has been with the department for 5 years. And prior to that, she spent 10 years in the natural gas pipeline industry and also worked for Phillips Petroleum. And today, we'd like to present components of the netback and some tariff history and where we are going forward.
And if you could help us by, you know, people at home, help us with what a netback is, so people at home could follow the conversation.
Okay, yes, sir, that will be part of the what we'll be going through.
Okay, go ahead.
My name is Joyce Lofgren. I'm, as Donna said, with the Department of Revenue. Here in Alaska, the state oil and gas leases and production tax statutes have us calculate royalty and tax based on a wellhead value. And oil is primarily sold on West Coast refineries, meaning that the wellhead value is calculated through a netback process that allows for the deduction of transportation costs to the point of sale. And there's basically two major components to these transportation costs, the pipeline tariffs and the marine or tanker costs. The pipeline tariffs are set by state and federal regulators. The intrastate rates are regulated by the RCA of Alaska, and the interstate rates are set by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The next slide here goes through the simple calculation of the netback process as estimated with February data. Starting with a West Coast price of $74.50, then less a marine cost of about $2 and a nickel, and deduct the TAPS tariff, and then a deduction for feeder pipeline, which what I've done there is a weighted average feeder pipeline cost. So for those deductions, we arrive at an ANS wellhead price.
Which is Alaska North Slope.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, Alaska North Slope. This slide is a historical picture of the TAPS tariff relative to the price of crude oil. And I've included this just to show that while it may not appear to be significant, that it is extremely significant for the Department of Revenue, because even though it may be nickels and dimes on as far as a tariff, it's times hundreds of millions of barrels, which mean millions of dollars to the department. So just take a couple of looks there, and you can see there were times when the TAPS tariff was half of what the price of crude was. So that's the reason I presented this, was to just show that while it's a small percentage now, it's still a very significant part. I'm going to go through a few slides here that are just is a litigation overview of where we started and where we have ended up. So please bear with me, because it's kind of where the economist bows out and the attorneys keep me straight on this. The initial TAPS tariff started in 1977 when TAPS began shipping oil. The initial tariffs filed were over $6. And the nature of how oil pipelines are regulated, the filed rates go into effect subject to refund until litigation is completed. And it's been controversial since the beginning, and the initial TAPS tariff litigation started in 1977 when the state protested the tariffs at the FERC and the RCA. In 1985, with no end to litigation in sight, the state and the TAPS carriers negotiated a tariff settlement.
And for those, just some of this, just for those watching at home, when a tariff gets paid to TAPS, who owns TAPS?
TAPS has, I should have pointed that out. It has five owners, and then there's also two different tariffs, the intrastate and the interstate.
And the owners are?
The owners are Conoco, ExxonMobil,
BP,
Unocal.
And
Chevron?
And Coke. It would be Coke now.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Industries, yeah.
So it's the same major participants in TAPS as in our oil basin, in Prudhoe and Kuparuk?
Correct.
Okay.
So the TAPS settlement agreement essentially created a formulaic method for calculating annual tariffs. And as I was just mentioning, that would involve then five tariffs because it's a joint ownership arrangement, and so it's kind of thought of as five separate pipelines, although it's just one. So it provided this rather complicated formula for calculating the tariffs for each pipeline, and also provided for an annual true-up based on what the actual costs were. It's important to remember that this settlement formula just merely set a ceiling on those filings, that they could charge lower should they choose. And a part of that agreement back then was that the state would not protest charges, the charged rate, unless it was higher than those derived from, and I have there, the TSM methodology. The TSM refers to the TAPS settlement methodology that has to do with how those tariffs were to be calculated. And the other reason, that it would not protest unless there were imprudent costs or otherwise things that were inconsistent with law. There were a few other provisions within the settlement agreement, which become important later on. It binds only the state and the TAPS carriers, and it left open the fact that third-party shippers were free to challenge the settlement rates at any time. And the state could audit annual filings. Also part of the agreement was that the agreement could be terminated by any of the parties January 1, 2009. Otherwise, the settlement agreement was set to expire at the end of 2011. Okay, so I'm going to separate kind of two separate worlds. First of all, I'll look at here at the intrastate rate litigation going on. So in December of 1996, Tesoro, Alaska protested the 1997 TAPS intrastate rates. 2002, the RCA issued Order 151, which ruled that the rates charged during 1997 to 2000 were not just and reasonable. They established a lower intrastate rate and they ordered refunds. In the interstate world, we had some things going on. In 2005, the state protested the carrier's interstate rates for unlawful discrimination. The state argued that there was a difference between, that the difference between the interstate and intrastate rates violated the settlement agreement, and the Interstate Commerce Act prohibits discrimination. Anadarko then protested 2005 rates as not being just and reasonable. Then the state and Anadarko protested in 2006, 2007, and 2008 rates based on the settlement calculation on the same grounds. Just about to get to the end of this.
That's fine.
Part. In May of 2007, FERC Administrative Law Judge Citrin issued an initial decision finding the TAPS 2005 and 2006 interstate rates were not just and reasonable. In June of 2008, FERC issued Opinion 502, affirming the Administrative Law Judge on all issues. Furthermore, they ordered the carriers to file new 2005 and 2006 rates based on the current FERC regulatory formula, which is a 154B methodology. They also ordered refunds based on refiled rates. Refunds for the 2006-2007 resulted in additional $600 million to the state for adjusted production tax and royalty liabilities. 2007 and 2008 rates were also protested. And FERC ordered the TAPS carriers to recalculate and refile their 2007 and 2008 annual rates based on the opinion 502 methodology. Refunds for the 2007 and 2008 resulted in additional $200 million to the state for adjusted production tax and royalty liabilities.
So could you give us an idea of what we're talking about in total tariffs a year on TAPS, ballpark number for marine transportation and tariffs? Are we looking at tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or upwards of a billion?
I don't have the numbers right at hand here.
That's fine.
But I can get those for you, Chairman.
For those watching at home, we're in the neighborhood of a billion in total shipping and TAPS tariffs. So it is a significant amount of money and counted in pennies.
Right.
Has a huge difference.
A huge difference.
So people understand at home what we're talking about and why we're taking the time to go over this stuff.
Like I was mentioned earlier, so if you're talking 250 million barrels a year, then a dime means, you know, $25 million. So small changes make big differences.
Mm-hmm.
Same time that the litigation was going on, the clock was ticking on the settlement agreement, and the settlement agreement terminated effective January 1. The state terminated the settlement, and the TAPS carriers filed their first post-settlement intrastate rates in the winter of 2008-09. The first post-settlement interstate rates were filed in the summer of 2009. So now we're in the post-settlement world of rates. The TAPS carriers filed their new intrastate rates at the end of 2008-2009, filed new interstate rates in the second half of 2009. The state and Anadarko have protested those rate filings, and a new hearing is to be held at FERC in October of this year. Okay, now we'll go to the numbers, which I'm a lot more comfortable with than the legal review here. This is a component of the TAPS tariff over time. And it's not to be confused with like total operating expenses, because you can see over on the left-hand side, it's a dollars per barrel that we're talking about. So how over time those components have changed. And you can see when the settlement agreement, not expired, but when we terminated the settlement agreement, where we started with low rates, and where we are today, and how the components of that cost of service is made up.
And that year was on the slide you just referred to?
The 2000, you mean when we went from the settlement agreement to the 502, that would have been, there you can see the drop in 2005.
That's a substantial change.
Yes, and it's very important to, as we'll get into how you figure the cost of service and how a tariff gets calculated, it's very important to see what the major component of the tariff is now, okay. And that is operating expense. Early on in the pipeline when it was new, you had a major chunk coming from depreciation. And of course, under the settlement agreement, you also had an after-tax margin and an income tax allowance, which is no longer part of the rate calculation, but that we have significant increases in the share of the tariff that is attributed to the operating expenses. The next slide is just a detail, kind of a general picture of building up a tariff. You can see you have operating expenses. And then you add to that the return of the rate base, which is essentially depreciation, and then you have a rate that's on the remaining rate base after you've taken out the accumulated depreciation. And then there's a component for AFUDC, which you can see at the bottom is an allowance for funds used during construction, which is significant if you have a large capital investment that's not in the rate base yet.
So is that, does that include all capital expenditures going forward, or is this left over from the initial construction? Help us separate that.
Well, once it's in the construction project, so you have some capital investment, but it may take a period of time before that gets to be put into the carrier property in service. And so in that's the process in the interim of allowing them a return for those funds that they use during construction. And so a cost of service becomes the sum of all of those, which is, you'll often hear referred to as the total revenue requirement. The total revenue requirement being, you know, kind of what it says, that what the pipeline must get to cover all of the costs of operating the pipeline. It's kind of explain the two axes on this. The one's kind of blurred on over there on the other side. And the one side, the left-hand side, we have millions of barrels per year. And so that would be the production is what we're measuring on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, it's dollars per barrel. And all I was trying to do here was to lead into the significant impact that production has when you're calculating a tariff. Because we get so focused on the numerator sometimes, the cost part, that we lose track of the fact of how important the throughput or the deliveries are when you do that division to come up with a tariff.
So can we back up a little bit?
Sure.
That previous slide. And go over again the difference between the TAP settlement agreement methodology and opinion 502 and the shift down, and we're under 502 right now, is that correct?
Correct. Under this TAP settlement agreement, there was an after-tax margin that was part of the cost of service or the total revenue requirement. And that was started out at 35 cents a barrel back when the settlement agreement was entered into. And that was part of the settlement agreement, was that would increase at the rate of inflation. So, and then, of course, being cost of service, you need to also, that was part of the return to the pipeline, and so it needed to also be figured in the income tax allowance. So that is the red and the green components back here in our bar chart. And you see those disappear once we go from the settlement agreement to the opinion 501, which is strictly a cost-based tariff.
So if we back up a little bit, back to that other chart, the one you just jumped off of, it's not numbered, but the one with the three lines on that one. So that spread between the opinion 502, and if we were under the TAP settle agreements, could be somewhere around $650 million on 240 million barrels over a year. You don't have to calculate it, but I think that's the magnitude of what we're talking about.
Right.
$650 million. That then backs up to the wellhead and adds value to the wellhead and increases the state share. Is that correct?
Well, it's right if you're talking about under 502, as opposed to being at the higher tariff level resulting in a lower wellhead. If you lower the tariff, then you will have a higher, a higher wellhead.
Right. It's just sometimes it's nice when, you know, not only for us, but the people at home to actually see the magnitude of the dollars working in. And here we've got over $500 million and we're just flipping through it like it's just normal everyday stuff. Makes a huge impact.
It does, right.
Well, as Joyce just went through how we arrive at the cost of service or the total revenue requirement, the other component piece of calculating the tariff, of course, is the throughput. And the tariff increases if the costs increase, if throughput declines, or there's a combination of both. On the next slide, we're seeing the throughput that would be required to maintain our 2010 tariff level. There are things that are being done to address the throughput issues. For example, Alyeska Pipeline has been undergoing and studying the, going through the low flow studies to understand the impacts of reduced throughput. They believe that TAPS will continue to operate in a safe and efficient manner for the plan period with additional investment. They're saying the physical life will last as long as the integrity of the pipeline and the facilities are maintained adequately to allow continued safe and environmentally sound transport of crude. The other significant area that Alyeska Pipeline has been working with is with the strategic reconfiguration. The key benefit of that being the new pumps have afford the scalability to vary pipeline throughput.
You've razzled and dazzled me so much with your chart, I'm not sure what I'm looking at.
You're not sure? Oh, we thought you'd like that chart. That's a...
Could you maybe walk through it for us, if you could?
Joyce, do you want to walk through your chart?
Yes. What we've done here as the... to come up with the amount of throughput that we would be required for us to maintain our tariff level in the tariff level, even though as we're forecasting the top part of the equation, the cost of service, and including in it the increases in OPEX, the increases in the components that were happening, the level of throughput. And so over on the right-hand side, you can see in terms of the volumes per day, that in 2011 it's like 12,000 additional barrels per day, even given the increase in the cost of service, that a level of throughput that increases, you could still have the tariff not increase. And so that's the point of this table, is to sort of show that you don't necessarily have to have increased tariffs just because the cost of service is going up if you in fact have increases in throughput. But what our earlier graph was showing is when you really get the double whammy is when you have the cost of services going up and the throughput going down, which is the case that we experience, then you have the combination effect. And so this chart here was just to kind of give you an idea of the volumes you would be talking about.
So there was and a statute change that allowed the state to put forth a fair and reasonable tariff, or some language, and I don't have it right in front of me. Could you help us with that?
But there's a reasonableness test as far as what is the reasonable cost of transportation.
Mm-hmm. How does
and the regulations are being... are going to be implemented as to the procedure that the Department of Revenue we will be doing to calculate what is reasonable for the transportation.
And can you help us with those regulations? Are they, when they're going to be in place, or update on that? And if you're not prepared for that, that's fine.
I'm really not prepared. They're out for comment now, and mm-hmm. perhaps
we can take that up another time.
Okay.
But that'll be a subject matter, I guess, as
well. They're essentially a cost-based methodology for comparing to determine the reasonableness.
Okay, and at some point we need to go over that particular issue and how it interties with or impacts our tariff.
Okay. I might mention, it wouldn't impact the tariff as much as it would determine what the Department of Revenue would allow in terms of taxes.
Okay.
But it wouldn't affect the tariff necessarily. Okay. Well, I'll just kind of wrap up with where we are and what we kind of see going forward as far as tariffs. The one thing that has come down and is still not totally ironed out because there's some issues with pooling agreements between the owners of the pipeline, but that the FERC ordered there will be a uniform rate, so we now have one rate on taps rather than five rates on taps, and that filed rate is $4 and 10 cents. We are now, there is no settlement agreement between the TAPS carriers and the state. And part of the operating under the old settlement agreement was that we had access on an annual basis to rather detailed data that the carriers were filing. Well, now that we're under no settlement agreement, we have no data other than what they file with FERC whenever they file with FERC. And so what we can glean from those filings is the extent of the information we have.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often do we audit their operating expenses?
It's been some time, I believe, since TAPS has been audited. It has been...
In your previous slide, there's a heck of a jump there after the issues with... The
ruling, that it really took it down.
We just have one person talk at a time because it scrambles up the recorders.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
It seems like it's taken off, and I just wondered how often we're auditing that.
Okay, go ahead and answer.
Okay, through the chair, I don't believe that we audit the TAPS, that we audit the tariff.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Another thing which you probably sensed from my earlier sort of skip through the litigation history is that we are now in a state of where we are experiencing stacked rate filings and protests because we have five different owners, we have two different regulatory bodies, and they file and we protest and they begin to stack up so that the later ones can't be resolved till the earlier ones get resolved, so it's getting very complicated. And some of the unresolved issues that are just sort of interwoven in part of all this FERC going on in the hearings and such deals like with the life of the line and rate of return, which is of course always an issue, and some of the operating expenses are being questioned at the FERC. I mean, just because the state doesn't audit the TAPS, it doesn't mean that the FERC doesn't question things that are that's in the TAPS tariff.
Senator Thomas, you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the components of the TAPS tariff. Currently, anyhow, the second greatest component is other. And it's probably just a rough guesstimate, 12-13%. What makes up that other?
That's the rate of return. And so part of that, because the oil pipelines use trended original cost rate making, then there's two components to their rate of return. One of them is the return on equity on the rate base, and another one is a deferred return. And so that would encompass both of those components of return.
Do you know what those are in ballpark figures, in percentages, the rate of return on equity and the...
I think it's like maybe 12%, 12 to, and that was part of the big jump, the 12 to 14%. Either last, I believe it was in 08, if not early 09, that the FERC put out a policy where they now allow a DCF method, which allows the master limited partnerships for determining a proxy group to determine the rate of return on the rate base, which was significantly higher than in previous years.
And your estimation, that is 12 to 14%?
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any other questions? I think that concludes your slides.
That concludes my slides, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any final comments? Okay. With that, I'd like to thank you ladies for coming forward today and sharing us with us some information on the tariff. Tomorrow at 9 a.m. sharp, we're going to fire off with lease expenditures with the Department of Revenue, so we're going to start increasing the complexity here fairly quickly, and we'll work on that tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Meeting adjourned.